I had the strangest experience while in that meditation just now. This thing happened in my mind, which was as if there was like a fly buzzing around. So why is everyone laughing? Really? Really? Don't tell me. My fly escaped from my brain. When I was in Perth, I was speaking to some people. And this one lady in the Buddhist Society was telling me that she used to share a house with some people. And they got into the... it was a couple, husband and wife, she shared the house with. And they used to get in the habit in the morning at over breakfast time that they would tell each other their dreams from the night before, and they used to do this every morning. And after a while they noticed it became very strange, because they noticed that their dreams became more and more similar, and they started to like have the same kinds of dreams and the same things happening in their dreams. I said, wow, that's amazing. I said, didn't that cause any problems sometimes? She said, yeah, well, eventually it caused the whole thing to fall apart, because I told my dream one night and one morning, and it was actually the dream of the affair that the husband was having. And... became very quiet around the table as the wife realized who the woman in the dream was and what she was doing with the husband. Slightly disturbing, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You think that your minds are kind of that leaky. We like to think that we're kind of contained in here somehow, and if we don't say it, and if we can kind of control our expression and our body and things like that, we can kind of keep our minds private. But it's not always so easy. So this is one of the things that I've been looking at and contemplating for the last little while. This is this kind of great, I think it's really a great mystery of the mind in its kind of the inner, our inner experience of the mind and the external physical realm, which is perceived by the mind. And somehow we've managed to work ourselves into a situation where we think that the external physical world is more real than the mind in here. And of course the basic assumption of science that the kind of the physical world is real and the mind emerges from that. No, I shouldn't say a basic assumption of science, but a theory of the mind which is believed by many scientists, that the external, the physical world is somehow real and that the mind emerges from that, whereas in fact the experience is exactly the reverse. Experience is that what we actually directly experience is the mind, and what we know about the physical world we infer from what we've experienced in the mind. So this is one of the basic things that we process as we go through doing vipassana meditation. You know, one of the first things that you learn when you're doing vipassana is that you recognize things for what they are, but you don't sort of ascribe meaning to them, you don't give them a name. So for example, if you have like the senses, you know, you hear something in meditation, you learn that's just a sound. It's not a sound of something. That's just all it is. And so we try to strip away the significance that we ascribe to it. I'm not saying that, you know, absolutely need to do that, but I'm just saying that's the way that you learn to understand the process. Obviously, we need to ascribe meaning to things to live and to get by. But it's a matter of distinguishing between them so that we can understand how our mind works. And so that, you know, sound has a different meaning to different people. And it was interesting on the retreat, you know, you can see these kinds of things. The sounds, the same kind of thing might have a very different meaning to different people. And for example, the sound of somebody walking past in the meditation room, might for most people might mean nothing. But one of the guys on the retreat was a cop, and he's like, every time somebody walks in the meditation room, he's kind of ready to leap up and go into defensive pattern. And he's just really having to deal with this the whole retreat. He's got this hyper alertness. He's been trained into it for so many years. So we react, our mind gives meaning and importance, significance to senses, things we receive from the senses. And through that we kind of infer and we build up this idea of what the world is around us in a way that's reasonably dependable. And so our map of the external world is reasonably dependable in the sense that, well, if we, want to go from one room to another, we generally choose the door rather than the wall, and that works for us most of the time. It might not work for us all of the time, but generally speaking, our map of the world is good enough. We know if we have a bowl of cereal in the morning, we eat the cereal and not the spoon. And, again, that works for us most of the time. We get by. It's not necessarily perfect. For example, there's a restaurant in America, of course only in America, where they print the menus onto rice paper out of organic vegetable dyes. So you can actually tear up the menu and throw it in the soup as the croutons in the soup. And so that kind of blurs the boundaries between something being a label and being the thing itself. But anyway, generally speaking, the labels work for us, they function, that's why they survive, but that doesn't mean that they're true. The same thing, I've always thought that this is the same thing in scientific truth. It's not necessarily absolutely true, but it works well enough. And the thing with science is that it's scientific, or what we think of as objective truths, they kind of seem real when looked at in a certain way, but then when you sort of chase it down, when you really kind of hone in on it, it all kind of disappears, and you realize, well, what do you have? I'll just give as an example, like we were talking about the mind and the body and the relationship between them. Now, as you know, there's various kinds of ways the mind can influence the body. So, for example, quite a well-attested phenomena is that people can heat up parts of their body, either just volitionally or under hypnotic influence. So you can kind of say, I want my right hand to get hot, and concentrate on it, and it does. It actually changes. Of course, this being the similar phenomenon practiced by the Tibetan monks to keep themselves warm in their caves in Tibet. So we actually change, there's an actual physical change. You concentrate on that and the blood flow increases or whatever, and it becomes warmer. But of course, what's curious about these things is how we think that we've kind of explained it by saying, well, it's through suggestion or through concentration or something like that. But really, what is that actual link between what the mind's doing and what happens physically? And we can try to kind of explain it through, you know, neural pathways and blood circulation and yada yada yada, but at the end of the day, what does that really explain? One of the things is that we don't really have to go to such exotic phenomena to figure that out. Even the most ordinary basic things are still just as mysterious. You know, if you want to move your arm, you move your arm. What's actually doing that? I move my arm now, and I think to myself, what? It's in one place, and then it kind of moves to another. And we have this idea, we think of this concept of volition, that we have a volition and it causes us to move the arm from one place to another. But when you look into your mind normally, you can't, where is this thing called volition? You know? I mean, volition is, most of the time we don't see it, we kind of infer it. You can actually catch it when your mindfulness is sharp. If you're doing insight meditation, you can actually catch the volition. This is one of the things that they train you to do at a certain stage in developing in the Mahasi technique, or at least when I did it. And so you actually look for and note the volition, but volition is very hard to catch. It's hard to pin down. What is this thing, volition? I don't know if you've ever notice this thing in sitting in meditation. And you sit, and there's almost a ripple or an emergence that comes in your mind of a kind of a wanting to do something. So there's like mind is like a kind of still water or something, and you can see this. It's almost like the fish is sort of coming up underneath the water, and you see the ripples before you see the fish, and there's a volition to do something. So usually if you're in meditation, it'll be like to change your posture or to scratch an itch or something like that, and you just catch just that instant before you actually do anything, there's like that kind of movement. And it's quite interesting, because if you catch it, I'm sure you've experienced that in meditation with the itching or something like that. If you catch it, you can always catch the volition, which is almost suspended in that instant before it's actually followed through or carried out. And you can actually just catch it suspended and hold it there. And it's incredibly tense. And this kind of, you know, you really, really, really want to scratch that itch, you know? And it's really hard to not do it. And you just hold that there, and this volition wants to manifest itself. It wants to make itself real. And you just kind of hold it, and gradually it'll kind of fade away. But it's sneaky. Sometimes it fades away, and then it hides in the background. Waits until your attention wavers, and then it leaps out again and scratches the itch while you're not looking. Yeah? Have you ever had that happen? Oh yeah, that's fine, I'll let go of that. Don't worry. Yeah. A minute later you find yourself scratching and you don't realise how it happened. So it's really interesting to see how these things that we think are very normal and straightforward actually are very, when we look more closely at them, the more we look at them, the more they disappear. And I think this is really important to keep this perspective in mind, and especially when we're thinking about these questions of like the mind and the body and these kinds of things. What actually is that? What is that? We have kind of, in science there's almost this kind of idea that by saying that the mind is nothing more than the body, that we've explained something. But we haven't really explained anything, have we? I mean, there's no kind of idea how any of these things happen. How is it that I can make my hand hotter by thinking about it? How is it that I can survive for days on end without my heart beating? Which has been, I mean, I can't do that, but it has been recorded. How is it that you can move your arm when you want to? And there's no kind of explanation for that. When you really sort of come on down and see what actually are those things. So this very fundamental question of like, what is the mind, what is the body, how are they related, what do they mean, what do these things mean? The more you look at it, the less obvious it seems. When we sit in meditation and we bring our mindfulness into the body, we can feel what the body is like. You get an awareness. Your body is like feeding back to you what it is. You can feel where the position of your body is. You can feel the temperature of it. You can feel the tensions or energies in different parts of the body, and so on. And of course, as we know, that not everything that we perceive through our body is actually true, or is actually, you know, well, I shouldn't say it's true, it's true as a perception. It's not necessarily accords in any simplistic way with what a doctor might see if a doctor looks at the body. Yeah? So you can have, for example, referred pain. Very common phenomenon in dentistry and other kind of things, where you feel as if a pain is in one place, in fact the injury that's causing the pain is somewhere else. And that's very common, it's very normal. Or other kind of common phenomena like kind of placebo effect and so on. Or the well-known phenomena where if you have your leg is chopped off, then you know you still feel as if it's there. So you still feel as if your leg is still there, and you can feel your toes wriggling and these kinds of things, even though it's not there. Well, the opposite thing also happens, where the leg is still there and you feel that it's not. Yeah? All of these kinds of distortions and shifts in the perception. And so what they tell us is that the way that we perceive our body doesn't have any simple or direct sort of one-to-one relationship between what we experience in the mind and what's actually happening in the so-called real world, or in the physical realm. There's a complex relationship between them. And we know that the mind, we know of course that the body affects the mind. Yeah? So if you hit yourself with a hammer on your thumb, your thumb has, you know, bruising and blood flow and so on. Your mind has ow, yeah, that bit's in your mind. So your body affects your mind, and also, as we know, the mind affects the body. And again, we don't have to go to exotic phenomena to look at that, but sometimes the exotic phenomena are more revealing in special ways. But even just ordinary phenomena, ordinary movement, volition, talking, everything we do, our mind is constantly influencing the body. So there's always this kind of interconnection, interrelationship. So when we have this inner picture of the body as we perceive it, which in meditation, that inner picture becomes more and more clear, becomes more and more well defined. You get a much more kind of solid, much more clear idea of what your body is like from the inside. And I believe that inner perception of the body is closely related to what in Buddhism they call the manomaya kaya, the mind-made body. So the mind-made body is essentially an energy body which is able to be projected. It's like the Buddha said, it's like drawn out of this body, like a sword drawn out of a sheath, and then can be projected. So this manomaya kaya can be, for example, can be multiplied, so you can make many copies, or you can do astral traveling and these kinds of things. So I and the Buddha described it as being manomaya as being complete in all of its limbs, sabhanga pachangam. So all the parts of the original body are still present there, and ahinindriyam, so not deficient, not lacking any faculty. It means it has all its senses intact. So that means that the manomaya kaya must be it has some kind of physicality to it. It has a rupa. If it's not lacking any limbs, that means it has a shape. And if it has all the senses intact, that means, you know, you can see and you can hear and so on. And if you can see, that means that you can somehow interact with photons. So there has to be some kind of physical or energy basis there, which is related to, but not necessarily, but not identical in every respect with the physical body and the energies produced by the physical body. Now we know something about those things. Like if you sit there in meditation, you can feel, for example, that the different parts of your body have a different kind of heat. Yeah, your head feels like something, your hands feel like something, your feet feel like something. Yeah, so for example, as I'm sitting here, I can feel my feet feel a little bit cooler than most of the rest of my body and so on. So we have heat, and that has a partially an objective component. You can measure it with a thermometer, and partly a subjective component. Yeah? You can be in the same temperature but feel cold or feel hot. But even the objective phenomena of heat, you know, it's not as obvious as we might think. I mean, you can, for example, make an infrared snapshot of a person's body. Yeah? So if you're sitting there and maybe your feet are cold, you could take an infrared, that's your inner perspective, so you feel your feet are cold. Somebody else can take a snapshot of you, and they can show on an infrared camera that, yes, your feet really are cold, therefore experience and reality match up. But what really does that mean? Like what actually is happening? When we say something's cold, we think that we've explained that because that's a simple physical concept that we all understand. But when we really look at what heat and cold is, heat is nothing. Heat doesn't exist. Heat is just the average velocity of the particles that make up whatever it is. So the fact that it's an average velocity tells you right from the beginning that it's actually something statistical. It's not something precise. Right? Temperature is a statistical average of velocity. But even that really doesn't tell us very much, because it's a velocity of what? It's a velocity ultimately of subatomic particles, but you know, we don't know really what subatomic particles are. And we don't really know what velocity is. Ever since Newton, we think we know what velocity is. It's rate of, you know, change of distance over time. But do we know what these things mean? Do we know what time means? Newton never explained what time means. Einstein never explained what time means. What's time? Nobody actually knows what time is. So we think we've explained something by saying that the temperature is like this or like that, but actually we haven't really explained anything. We can point to patterns, we can point to similarities, we can point to parallels, we can point to correspondences. But that's all that they are. So there's no kind of refuge, I don't believe, in this kind of so-called objective truth. I'm not trying to dismiss it. I'm not trying to say it's not worthwhile. I'm just trying to say it's not the final answer to everything. when you're meditating, you know, and you're experiencing changes in your mind, you're experiencing changes in your body. Well, maybe that has some kind of measurable impact externally. Maybe if somebody measured that with an MRI machine, then the metta that you develop in meditation might make a change in the reading on an MRI machine. But what does that tell you? An MRI machine measures measures magnetic fields are roughly proportional to blood flow, because the blood has iron in it, and so you can say roughly that areas of the brain with increased magnetic strength have more blood flow and therefore somehow are being used, but it really doesn't tell you very much. It's a very rough instrument. You learn much more from the inside. If you have that feeling of metta, you can see it much more precisely, much more clearly. You can see the changes in it. You can see how individual thoughts about an individual person can change the feeling of metta very drastically. You can feel how it responds in each part of your body in quite clear and specific detail. You can see all kinds of things that an MRI scan can't pick up. So when we're looking at understanding the mind from inside here, from inside this body, we're using an instrument which is far more precise and far more delicate than anything that's been developed externally. One of the things that happens during meditation, especially during deepening of insight in meditation, is that mind, as it gradually sheds its illusions, it sees the world in ways that, through different stages, that will be strange or unusual, sometimes even frightening, in different ways. And it can be quite disconcerting if you're not ready for it or not used to it. You know, for example, you know, quite common one is in meditation is to see everything just falling apart. So you're sitting, if you've been developing perception of impermanence, you reach a certain point in your meditation where, you know, everything just literally is just collapsing all around you, just like a building is falling down around you. Or you can have like a kind of strange feeling of disconnect, the kind of unifying linkages of the senses can be kind of broken. You see each sense operating quite independently and not kind of making kind of unified things out of it. So you stop making the world, the unified world, out of your sense information. So all of these things can happen, and many other different kinds of phenomena can happen. And they're all kind of a sign of different stages of the mind developing its wisdom and developing its insight, so that it's undoing the illusions that we usually make up the world, make up this kind of comforting, solid, reassuring world that we live in. So as we're meditating and doing the insight or vipassana meditation, this is the kind of way that we learn to see the different vipassana techniques that people will teach are all in one way or another trying to get people to sort of break through or to see through the constructs and so on that we usually order the world, how we've built up that world in our mind. Try to see things afresh. So of course, as I mentioned before, you sort of can't do that. Practically, you can't do that. Practically, the way that we see things is useful. But the problem is that we mistake that useful truth for being the actual way things are. The way things are is actually far more mysterious, far more complex, far less amenable to kind of simplistic formulations or explanations than we like to imagine it is. Well, that's probably long enough then, if... Yeah, is there any questions or comments anyone wants to do, other than the one we just heard?
I have a comment. I find it really interesting about quantum physics, how science basically discovered that it seems it needs consciousness to make reality.
Right.
And you're very troubled by this.
Yes, yes. That's right, and and there's this kind of resistance to the idea that it actually has any significance. You know, in every other realm of science you can go on as if existence was still objectively out there in kind of solid things, all the way kind of this kind of nagging doubt in the back of your mind that actually when you really hone down to it, they're not. And I think that there's a loop there. I think there's a loop, and I think it's hidden by speciality. I always think, like, if you want to know what the mind was, and you want to find out from in the Western world, you want to find out what the mind is, well, you go to the psychology department, you say, what's the mind? And they say, well, the mind is, you know, perception and memory and thought and consciousness and blah, blah, blah. Yes, but what is it really? What's it made of? And then they say, well, the mind is actually just the brain. So they'll tell me, what's the brain? They say, well, we can't tell you what the brain is. You have to go to the biology department. So you go next door to the biology department and say, well, I've heard that the mind is the brain. I want you to tell me what this brain thing is. And they say, well, the brain is kind of neurons and networks, and there's this cortex and that thalamus thingy and this amygdala and blah, blah, blah. Yes, but what are all these things? What are they made of? They say, well, they're made of organic chemicals, proteins and so on. Well, tell me what about these organic chemicals. Well, we can't tell you that. You have to go next door to the chemistry department. So you go to the chemistry department and say, tell me about these proteins and so on and so forth. So they explain about carbon and the links between carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, and how they form all these complex chemicals and so on. You say, but what are these chemicals made of? And they say, well, they're made of, you know, atoms and protons and electrons. Well, what are those? Well, we don't know. You have to go next door to the physics department. You go to the physics department and say, right, I want to know what atoms are. And they say, well, there's protons and neutrons and electrons and blah, blah, blah. Yes, but actually, what are these things? And they say, well, actually, we don't even know if it's a wave or a particle. You know, if you look at it, if it's observed, it switches from being a wave to a particle. So, well, what's this observer thing? And they say, well, we don't know. You have to go next door to the psychology department and find out what that is. And I really think that's how kind of we've got, you know, there's actually a lot, that kind of explanatory process, it just goes in a loop. You never actually explain anything ultimately. You explain something with reference to something else. And I think it's unfortunate that there's nothing holding it all together. It's just everyone's talking at their own, just one kind of level. But I think the physicists generally seem to have a better idea of this than a lot of the others.
I think some of them are talking
to you in that way. I think so, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Although it's mostly the, you know, the psychology and the neuroscience talking together. But yeah, certainly there is some interaction between them.
At the level you're talking about, I
hope they don't. Things?
Yes, I hope they don't.
What kind of thing could it possibly be to be an explanation? Yeah? People always think that there is. I mean, when Newton came out, everyone thought he'd explained everything.
When you were talking about volition there, and sort of, you know, bubbling up, volition like that, which I always find very interesting. Isn't that just the will? Sankara?
In Pali, yeah, that's just translation of it, yeah. Sankara, yeah, Chetana.
Yeah, okay. So when you talk about volition, that's what, isn't it?
Yeah.
Are you just meant to suppress the volition, or are you just...
In meditation?
Yeah.
In meditation. In that kind of context, yeah, you're just to observe it, yeah? So that it comes up, and just kind of watch it without reacting to it. It's actually, I mean, even that kind of level of insight is actually very liberating.
Mm.
Because then you realise actually you can just have them and just watch them and then they just go away. Mm. So you're not under the control of the volition.
The volition is like breathing in.
That what, sorry?
If the volition is, I want to breathe in.
No, you don't have to. You just, if you want to, you just watch it. But that's a good question. I've had that in my meditation as well. You get to a certain point when you're doing the meditation, and you realise that there is an actual some kind of volitional content to breathing, and you catch that, just as you've caught the volition to move and scratch. Absolutely, and you just sit there and just watch the volition.
The thing is, just observe the volition rather than actually responding to it by breathing in.
Mm.
You end up breathing in anyway.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
The breathing is what could have got your, I suppose, the lower parts of your brain are controlling
That's right. So you watch that process and what happens. It kicks in and then you see the fear coming and blah 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 and everything, and just got to keep watching. Eventually,
you'll breathe. Holding your breath is a volitional process too. I mean, you can't hold your breath.
But that's a different thing, though.
Yeah, but that's also volitional. I mean, there's a volition of wanting to breathe in, because there's also holding your breath is. You haven't achieved anything. You hold your breath.
No, yeah, but that's a different kind of thing, yeah. Having the intention to hold your breath isn't what we're talking about here. What we're talking about is just having the just
letting it.
You capture as the mind is forming the intention to breathe in. You just catch that volition and just watch that. So, but there's still volition. But the volition is not to hold your breath. The volition is to watch the volition. So you have the intention to watch that intention.
But watching the volition doesn't mean acting out on the volition, does it?
No,
necessarily. If you're talking about the bubbling up, but it's not breaking the surface.
Right. That's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you're not acting out. You're just watching it. Just observing. Eventually, of course, you'll still breathe. I don't know anyone who's died completely.
Well, then you're so intent on watching the volition that the natural breathing process just happens. You know what I mean?
It can do.
Well, that's what I've noticed that happen. You sort of, you know, because there's always a tendency to try and control, you know, observe the tendency to try and control your breathing. You observe that and act it out. And then the breath just comes natural.